Hello and welcome to the Principal Liner Notes podcast. This is Sean Gaylord and this is another connected conversation. I may sneak in some French because I have a guest who knows about as much French as I do. So we may go in en français, but nevertheless, this has been a long time in coming and I am so grateful that Deirdre Raymer is here with us here on the podcast. Deirdre, welcome.
Thank you very much, Sean. And it is a long time coming. I've followed the podcast for a long time and the kinds of guests you've had on are the people I also follow. So this is an honor to be invited today and I'm grateful to be here.
Thank you so much. We have so many mutual connections and mutual friends. And again, I'm just grateful that we're finally getting to chat and to talk. And I know part of the reason why it's kind of taken us a little bit of time is you've taken on a brand new role within the last 6 months.
I did. Yeah. I moved from being the assistant superintendent in a kind of a larger medium-sized district to the superintendent of schools for the school district of South Milwaukee.
Wow. Congratulations on that gig. And as I said before, we started recording this conversation. Your district is so lucky to have someone who is passionate about education, passionate about kids. Your path to this moment now is rooted in passion and rooted in student centeredness. And I would just love for you to kind of share your philosophy, your approach to being a leader who espouses student-centeredness. I just want us to go there.
Yeah, sure. So I was an assistant superintendent, like I said, for a number of years in a previous district. And prior to that, the coordinator of special ed, and I was a special ed coach and a teacher prior to that. So my whole career was centered in the human side of the work. I worked with some kids in a self-contained setting for kids with emotional and behavioral disabilities when I started my career. And the first day they said, "Hey, lady, do you know you signed up to work with the bad kids?" And I was like, "Whoa, let's start there. Nobody's a bad kid. Right now, I'll tell you, I've read your records. You're a little unskilled. So we have some work to do in that area, but you're not bad kids. We have to figure out where your passions are and what drives you." And that is just sort of how I've always was in the classroom. And that's how I lead, right? It's all about the kids finding their public education, their time in public school, their time in whether it's public or private school, K-12, should be about figuring out a little bit about who they are as people. And then a ton about what they want to be about. What do they want to do? What do they want to pursue when they're done with school? So taking that to that human-centered, how do we embrace what kids are all about as people and help them to develop the skills in which they need some development and help them to figure out the things that they're really passionate about? That's then how I went into a leadership role. And it just became then I started doing that with teachers when I was in a coach or a coordinator role. So I had to know a lot about the staff I was supporting in order to make sure they had what they needed so that they could support the students that were in front of them. And so that we always kept students at the center of what we were doing all the time. So when we were working with children who receive services through an IEP, what is it we want that student to know and be able to do? And do we have the current skills to be able to facilitate that in the classroom? And if we don't, let's go get some new skills. Let's go be better and let's go try some new things. And then that work became about doing that work with principals and coaches and leaders and then teachers as well. And now that's the same. I get to do a lot more work in this role with the community, which has been amazing. I serve this beautiful community that comes together around all kinds of things in such a lovely way and get to do that with our school board. And then I'm leading a team of directors and principals and teachers as well. So it's always about what is it we want for the kids that we're able to, that we get the opportunity to serve every day. And then do we have the support and the skills that we need? That constant balance of push and support for students to learn a bit more and grow a bit more. And then that's the constant balance of push and support for teachers and for leaders too, to make sure that we're always keeping that at the forefront of what we do.
Wow. That actually reminds me of one of my very first principal gig, I guess going on maybe 16 years ago. My supervisor, who assistant superintendent at the time, one of the most powerful pieces of advice that she gave me that still stays with me is basically taking a blank piece of paper. And she told me to do this at the kind of my first faculty meeting. And she said, draw a circle. And in that circle, write the word students. And then basically that served as my kind of visual mantra as a leader. Students are at the center. Students are at the center of our universe. Someone has entrusted us with the center of their universe. And we have to fulfill that. We have to serve that. We have to support that. In terms of being a student-centered leader, student-centered educator, do you have what's your EQ? Do you have a visual mantra? Do you have a mantra? Like, you know, when you're in a meeting and folks are pushing against that student-centered mindset or are trying to disrupt the vision and the mission for the district or school to be student-centered, what is it that you use or what is your go-to?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of reflective questioning. I don't know that I necessarily have a mantra. The one I've been using a lot recently was one I learned from the superintendent I worked with for a long time as the assistant, Dr. Marty Lexman, who just was all about the human-centered approach to the work too. And it was beautiful and lovely. But he said all the time, we have to stop making it about what's wrong and we have to make it about what's possible. Mm. And that is something I do say an awful lot, right? We have to stop figuring out why we can't do it or what's wrong with what we're doing or right. And it's about what's possible. What would happen if we just tried to do something different? What is the worst thing that could happen? And then guess what's the best thing that could happen, right? What would happen if we, several years ago, we took a group of high school teachers and a bunch of their students off site for the day and we planned instructional units together. And at first the teachers were like, let's see what happens. Maybe we're going to use those instructional units and maybe we're just going to spend a super great day with some kids. And maybe we're going to say, well, that was the worst instructional unit we've ever planned and we're not going to use them. But let's see what happens if we try that. And it was beautiful. And the kids gave really good feedback, some of which was hard to hear because the teachers worked so hard on the plans. And then some of it was like, okay, if that's really how the students are feeling, then we have to start making a shift because it has to be about what's possible for them.
That is, I mean, it's easy to say this is horrible. It's easy to kind of throw that at a wall or this is impossible or but it does take reflection. It takes humility. It takes kind of leaning in. It's hard work to kind of say, well, what is possible? Or especially when you're dealing with the unknown or especially when you're dealing with things that are seemingly impossible. So, it's good. It's easy to, what's wrong? What's right? Yeah. What's right with what, or what's the best thing that could happen? Let's manifest that. Right.
And I think I'm also naturally empathetic. Like that was just the gift I was given. And so for me, a lot of times it's helped me understand. Like, why are you struggling with this? Help me understand. Because if I understand it from the perspective of the adult, then I can better support that adult to make the shift that they're looking to make. And so that part of the work, like the help me understand, what would you need from me right now? What's the support you would need to be able to do this? Because they think that's something naturally in the world of education, teachers say, well, I need more support. But sometimes what I feel like we struggle to say is what would support look like? So help me understand what that would look like.
Yeah.
Help me understand what that would look like. And sometimes they don't know, right? They're not sure. Help me understand what that would look like. Okay. Well, would you like to know what other people that I've worked with in the past have done? And sometimes that's like a helpful moment. It's really helpful as you're pushing into that student-centered space that you have actual goals on what that means you would do every day. Because that's such a broad terminology. Oh, we're going to become student-centered. What does that mean I do every day, right? Or if we want to say that we're aligned to a certain set of philosophical beliefs, what does that mean I'm going to do in my classroom every day? And how does that look different than what I'm doing? Because I have never once worked with an educator who doesn't come to work every day with just the absolute utmost care for the kids in front of them every day, and the intention on everyone in that class feeling good and feeling successful. I work with an incredible set of educators right now who walk in the doors every single day with that intention. And then sometimes we have students who are doing okay with that, and sometimes we have students that aren't. So in that student-centered approach, it becomes our job to think about the whole picture of the student and then what we actually want them to learn versus necessarily what we wanted to make sure we got done within the content or the curriculum. And that shift isn't drastic for teachers who start with the human-centered, relational-driven work. It's not a drastic shift. It's just a matter of thinking differently about how we plan instructional lessons or thinking differently about the experiences that we're offering in school to make sure that we're always building that sense of belonging and we're pushing kids to communicate and problem solve and collaborate.
Wow. So from a practical standpoint, and you just started going there. So from a practical and maybe a superintendent lens, I can tell you when I walk into a classroom, you can feel what mm-hmm. student centered is. But perhaps on the other senses, on the, you know, what does it sound like? What does it look like? What does it smell like? What are those things in terms of student centeredness for those that may be struggling with that, or it doesn't come to them naturally from a leadership level or even a classroom level?
Yeah, I think that's the right. That's the big part of the figuring it out. And we have to get away from the services for some kids being something different than that core academic space and that core classroom. That has to be an inclusive idea around being designed for the users that are coming to the classroom every single day. And also then covering the things that we know we need to cover when it comes to content and skills and things like that. And the hard part is some of those communication and collaboration problem solving skills, they're a little harder to measure than whether or not the kids know all the facts of a history unit or whether or not they can solve a formula for something. So those ones, they're harder to measure, but you can measure them. And you measure them a lot when kids talk about whether or not they feel a sense of purpose and belonging at school. So in the school district where I'm working now, they do a student survey every year. And they ask questions like that. Do you feel a sense of purpose in your work? Do you feel like you have a voice in decisions that affect you? And then they also ask employees, right? Because if the teachers don't feel equipped to do that, then the kids are never going to have those experiences in school. And so there's that constant balance of trying to make sure that we're pushing at the right pace to make sure we're hitting a student-centered approach, but yet providing all the right support for people to get there. And in my lens, from the superintendent lens, lots of that becomes just seeing what's going on and trying to be in classrooms when I can, as much as I can. And then trying to make sure that the leaders in particular have what they need. Because principal development and principal coaching, I think, is a very underdeveloped thing in a lot of places. And I prided myself on the work I did in my previous role around leadership development. Mm-hmm. And that's work I'm really intentional about right now, because the leader of that building, the principal of that school, has a lot more contact with the teachers and the students than I'm going to in my lens. So how do we ensure they know what they're supposed to be doing and what that looks like, and they have the right support, so every day the teachers can feel that same support? And that's newer to the group that I'm with right now. I started doing their principal evaluations, and a couple of them said, well, this will be new for me, because we don't often do a thorough evaluation process, even of the principal, from a reflective, what do we want the kids at the school to know and be able to do? And are you coaching the right experiences for them so that that's what's happening every day in our schools?
You know, principal development is something that is so key to sustaining not only a positive school culture and teacher retention and student achievement, and then also maintaining this ethos of student centeredness. But kind of like as for me as a principal, you know, my heart is in the classroom, and so I always kind of keep that in mind. That, you know, I try to put myself in that guy, you know, however many years ago, 20 years ago, was a high school English teacher. And I've never forgotten that guy. My heart is still there. And then I find that the best superintendents, the best kind of principal supervisors, not only do they have their heart in the classroom, but also their heart in being that site-based leader. I love when I've heard superintendents say, you know, the best job I ever had was when I was an elementary school principal. I had a supervisor one time that always would when she want actually is the same supervisor that did the students in the circle, Dr. Carol Montague Davis. She would always say, you know, when I was in the building, I used to do this, or when I used to sit in your chair, I would do that. Now it's your building, you know, but if I were you, I would maybe think about this way. And it was a beautiful hat trick that she would do to kind of create change and to inspire change. There are a lot of principal development programs, though, or principal schools, so to speak, that I think miss the mark on developing leaders or developing, you know, aspiring leaders. So what are the things that you've done in the past? I know in your previous role, previous district, you were director of leadership. As a superintendent, it sounds like you take that very, very seriously, where now you're doing the principal evaluations, and also sounds like you're doing a little bit of coaching. So what are those ways in which you're developing and supporting principals? Because we're it.
So, right. Yeah. And I think sometimes people think like somebody gets the job as the principal or a director or the superintendent, it's like, oh, I've arrived, right? Like I already got my schooling. And I recently had a session with all of our teachers and I said, hey guys, so we're clear, like I have an external coach. Just because I've earned the job that I'm in doesn't mean I know everything I need to know. So I have an external coach, and principals have a coach, and, you know, Michael Jordan had a coach the entire time he played basketball. And I think we can all agree he was pretty darn skilled at playing basketball, but yeah, he had a coach the entire time. Right. So that idea that coaching is about, what did I want to be able to do? And then am I getting there? What's the evidence I would collect that says I'm getting there? And if I'm not getting there, what are the resources and support I would need? Right. So I approach the principal training and coaching much in the same way I would like them to approach teacher coaching and training, because that's the experience I would want kids to be having every day on our watch. Does somebody ask them first? Like, hey, how are you feeling about this? You know, what do you think you're doing really, really well? And where do you believe that you need some additional support? What is it we want that building, when we look at the school improvement plan, to be able to demonstrate at the end of the year? And what will we need in order to make that happen? And then we design their principal meetings and things like that around some of that coaching. I have 6 principals now in my new role, and one of them affectionately called me a couple of weeks ago, Edward Scissorhands. Because he said, you guys, if you go in her office and you ask a question about something you feel like you need to learn, she's like Edward Scissorhands. She's like, whoa, whoa. She whips out a book. She whips out like a podcast. Mm-hmm. She whips out like a thing that's about me getting to be better at my job so I can better serve teachers and students every single day. And it's really about that reflective process and not me telling you how to be a good principal. First of all, I wasn't a building principal, right? In the course of my role, I had sort of a weird trajectory to end up where I am, where I hadn't actually applied for a job in about 17 years until the one I recently took, because other jobs just sort of, hey, Deidre, would you consider doing this job or that job in the organization I was in? And so one of the roles I never had was a principal job. I've substituted for principals so many times. I do feel like I at least have some skills in that area for sure. And I've coached principals for years, but it would be silly for me to design a meeting where I said, this is what I think you should go and do, because I don't know every student that they're trying to serve at that school. And I don't know every staff member and their skills and their efforts. What I do need to know is these are the big objectives we're working on as a system. These are the ones we know we need to hold in common across all 6 schools. And for the ones that we've agreed we need to hold in common at all 6 schools, my job becomes making sure you have the skills in that area to be able to go and lead the work. And so it's changed quite a bit how our district leadership team meetings have run in the past to how they run now, which is we spend a lot of time saying, what do we need this space to be for you guys to do the work of leading the school improvement plan and leading the work at the buildings every day? And they gave a list of skills that they would like to develop. And so each meeting we have is an opportunity to develop skills in the areas they've identified are the ones they need. And then when I have my individual meetings with them, we talk about the really specific things that that leader might need for the population that they get to serve, which is going to look different from one school to the next because kids aren't the same.
Wow. That's powerful. Your six principals are very lucky to learn with you and alongside you. And I'm just kind of getting, seeing you as the Edward Scissorhands. I do a similar move to where, get this book. Oh, here's the name of this person. And you just, you know, because we're so passionate about teaching and supporting the work. And that's so key to our role.
I will add to that, Sean, that I am also very lucky to get to work with those six individuals because I am fortunate to be supporting some really talented individuals with passion and heart a million ways forward.
Man, that's also key as well. Speaking of South Milwaukee, I would love for you to share the anecdote that before we hit record about how you heard something on the radio, you heard something on the walkie-talkie.
Oh yeah.
I love this story.
We have a walkie-talkie that tells us in the district office about things that are going on in the schools. And one of them was if a teacher makes a radio call to the office for some support from the middle school or the high school, because my office is attached. So if I hear them and if I'm not in the middle of a meeting or doing something I need to be doing, I just walk over. Like I can walk. I don't have to leave the building. I live in an area where it's getting really cold out. So I don't even have to leave the building. I just walk over. And the first couple of times I did it, people were like, what are you doing here? I'm like, oh, sorry, I heard a radio call and I had some time. So I thought I'd come over and, you know, see if you needed any help. And they're, you know, people are getting a little bit more used to that now. But if they see me in the hallway, you know, I needed the principal to go to a webinar. So I just cleared my schedule and I went over and I worked the radio in the office for a while and got to know some of the kids and understood a bit more about some of the teachers and what they needed from us. And I feel like if you don't do that, I don't know how you know how to help support the system, right? I have to know what it feels like from their lens, not mine, if I'm going to support them to make some shifts in what we're doing to make sure we're including all students in the instruction every single day. And we have so many beautiful bright spots in the district that I'm in right now. It's amazing, but we don't yet have a system that operates towards a common goal. And so that's really what we're trying to develop now. But yes, there was a couple of teachers who were like, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I just got to walk my friend back to class. Did you have a question? Because I can answer that, you know, no. And the looks I got, I thought, oh, this is new for you. Oh, okay. Right. But if I want everybody to be in that student-centered approach, I have to also be the person modeling what it looks like to be in a student-centered approach.
That's true. We have to walk that talk and model that. And, you know, there's certain information that we can get from a spreadsheet. There's data that we can get from a report. But also too, there's something about as leaders that we have to feel and experience it in order to understand and then support better and solve and reconcile and sustain. So that, you know, it's what I don't know if there's already a term for this, but I often refer to it as visible leadership. Yeah. And that visible leadership is that entry point to empathy, is that entry point to authenticity and keeping that core vision, you know, in the center, you know, or keeping that student centeredness, you know, front and center.
And I think that also is not just looking for feedback that everything's going fine. Right. So we have a student senate in the school district of South Milwaukee. That's amazing. Like they do some amazing work and they are knowledgeable and they're really invested. The students are, and they're frustrated by a few things right now. So I said, well, why don't I just come to the next meeting so we can talk about that and I can hear your frustrations. Or if a student emails me with a frustration about something, I always email back. Why don't we set up a time to meet? Because I do need to hear from them. And it can't just be the, you were about everything's going great. You know, I try to be at as many community events as humanly possible. So I recently went to, we had four amazing young athletes and incredible humans get to participate in the state swim meet. And I went to the swim meet and people again were looking at me like I had two heads. And a parent even emailed me and said, I cannot believe you came to the swim meet. And I thought, we have four people representing our community who have earned such an incredible honor and have worked so hard to be there, supporting them in that moment for a couple of hours. That did not feel like anything that was superhuman or above and beyond what I should be doing to just really know the whole community and what matters.
Wow. That's powerful. And what a great example of that kind of how that visibility and that presence truly does matter. I also know, that you've done a little bit of writing, and I kind of first learned about you through the chapter that you contributed to, I guess, a couple of years ago. Because of a teacher, stories of the past to inspire the future of education. And this is a collection of stories from various educators all over, talking about the impact of a teacher, the impact of an educator, written and curated by George Koros, and you are chapter three.
Yeah.
And inspiration for a lifetime and beyond, and here you write a very personal piece, and I was really moved and empowered by that chapter.
Thank you. Yeah, I wrote about my dad, who there's been some follow-up to actually writing that chapter since then. That was just such a, actually highlighted exactly why you'd write a chapter in a book around an individual like my dad. So my dad was a teacher, and he taught in Catholic schools primarily when I was growing up. And he was a coach. And so I spent most of my formative years in a gym and know the value of the community and the sense of belonging and purpose that a co-curricular can bring, especially athletics. That was kind of my background. My son feels that right now and he does theater and other things too. And my daughter loved that through music and musical theater and those pieces as well. But he was a coach, and so an athletic coach. So we spent a ton of time in the gym and all those places, and just watching the way he interacted with people is, I think, where I get a bunch of that empathetic lens, because he knew the kids and he knew their families. And the thing about my dad, that the stories that get told over and over and over again, because unfortunately my dad passed away many years ago when I was about 20. And so he died at the age of 52, which is super, super early. But the impact of, like, I thought I knew who he was and the way he interacted with people, but then when he passed away and we had hundreds of people coming to the services for him saying, I am the man I am today because of your dad. And, you know, this is how he helped me become not just an athlete, but like a human in the world. And this is where he took feedback and he understood how to take criticism of something he was doing and use that in a constructive way. And that's a lot about how I try to lead. Like, I want to hear from teachers or students when something's going really well. Please help me celebrate those moments, because that's the joy that drives us every day. But I also need to know when something's not right so that we can fix it. Like, and if we don't talk about that openly and you hold on to that, that makes your job really hard, really hard. And he just knew that. And so the chapter, like, where he started his career was at this little parochial school in Oak Park, Illinois, called St. Catherine's, which is now St. Catherine, St. Lucie combined. And right after I finished that chapter, I was super nervous. I had never written a chapter for a book. When George asked me, I kind of laughed out loud at first. I was like, I'm not doing that. And then I was like, all right, I'll give it a try. So I sat down one morning and just sort of cranked out this chapter, just living and breathing my dad and telling my husband and my daughter in particular stories about my dad all day. And my daughter said, Mom, you've never talked about him like this. And I thought, oh, that's a shame. She's like, I knew a lot about grandpa, right? But I didn't know all of these stories. And she could help me filter some of them, because my dad was kind of an unusual character. She's like, Mom, that story sounds kind of weird. And I was like, yes, the time my dad took me to a casino when I was 12, that probably, maybe I shouldn't exactly include that part of the story in a chapter that's celebrating him. It had a beautiful story to it. But she's like, maybe you could just change some of the words. Because just so you know, like, if you don't know grandpa, some of that sounds a little out there. And so I'd spent all day like telling them these stories about his impact on other people and his impact on me, but like his impact on other people. And I literally sent the chapter off. And a couple of hours later, somebody posted a Facebook post on an alumni page that was a picture of him coaching a team in 1969. I swear to goodness, this happened on the exact same day. I sent this chapter off a couple of hours later. And for 2 days, people flooded this thing with stories of him. And a lot of them I knew, and some of them I didn't. I didn't realize that women at the time that he was coaching at the school weren't allowed to play 5-on-5 basketball. They were only allowed to play 3-on-3 because it was prior to Title IX.
Yeah.
But he was like, well, that's dumb. Girls should be able to play like boys. And she let, right? So this woman wrote this really beautiful post about how that led her to play college basketball and led her to do these other things. And just the stories that people were telling about all the times he showed up and he just was there and he listened and he was a part of who they are as people. It was absolutely lovely. So they've recently had at that school, they had somebody who ran a fundraiser and ran a whole campaign to actually redo the gym where he coached that team. And the panel was trying to figure out who to name the gym after. And two guys from that team in 1969 nominated my dad to be have the gym named after him. And they said, well, we read that chapter about him. And I felt like you were telling some stories about that, about me. And I thought, one of you, I did actually quote you in that book that I wrote. And these two guys that he coached in 1969, all these years ago, said, if you're going to name the gym after somebody, you have to name it after Coach. And so last October, we got to go to the gym naming ceremony and had people, hundreds of people show up who he, I mean, my dad's been passed away, right, for many, many, many years. And so to have people still show up, and for hours, we had a dinner afterwards, and it was like an open mic night, and people just got up and talked about the impact he had on them as a human. And that's the lasting impact, right? And it wasn't just about the fact that he was teaching FIAT or teaching health, or one year he was teaching some science class. I'm like, do you even know, like, what, you know? yeah, fascinating. And when I was in his classroom and in the gym with him, but just, it wasn't just about like the stuff he wanted kids to know how to do. It was like who they were becoming and how did they contribute back to other people and make other people feel seen and heard. And that's just something that I try to live every single day.
Wow. And you can tell, and that, thank you for sharing that is kind of the postscript to the chapter, because I really fixated on this chapter and really connected with it for a lot of levels. I've learned a lot and still learn a lot from my dad, and probably you know, and my dad born and raised south side of Chicago, and so not too far from Oak Park.
Yeah.
And my dad did not end up becoming a PE teacher, but that was an aspiration of his, and his life took a different turn, and in many ways, and this is probably why I connect with you, is we are kind of the legacies of that for our respective dads. My dad is a natural teacher, and your dad's a natural teacher as well. And there's just something about legacy here that I'm feeling. And so thank you for that gift. Speaking of legacy, you mentioned in the brief survey I do before getting guests, booking guests and such. I have a question about music.
Yeah.
And I just loved how you framed music and you shared again another kind of personal connection to music. And I feel music very personally as well. It's that universal language that connects us. It's that divine thread that we're all kind of holding on together. And you kind of in just in two or three sentences nailed it. And I would love for you to kind of share, if you don't mind, with, you know, in our conversation here about how kind of the your connection to music and
yeah, you bet.
And your legacy.
Yeah. And some of that comes from my mom, actually. So my mom stayed at home with us when we were little and worked for a family business. And she was one of 10 kids. And she also, unfortunately, passed away at a pretty early age a few years ago. She was only 68 when she passed away. But we grew up in a house with one of those. It was like a enormous piece of furniture that when you slid the top open, it had a record player inside of it. Yeah. And so that
the hi-fi. Thing, yes.
Yes. Like, and it was huge and it weighed like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds. And we had to move it out of our house one day. I was like, oh, this might just be a permanent fixture. But she was playing records for us from the time we were little, and we would hang out in the kitchen and hang out in the living room and do like exercise records. And she was part of, she loved the opera, and we weren't a family of, you know, my dad was a Catholic school teacher and my mom stayed at home with us. Right. So we weren't exactly the most affluent people in the world. We were certainly, we did fine, but, so it was such a treat that my mom was like, she got a membership to the opera and was in this opera society and things like that. And so I grew up in a house that was also full of music, and the music having stories and lots of musical theater and the way you tell a story through music and opera and things like that, that I just really glommed onto. And so I was never a musician myself. I will not bother to share any of my poor singing ability with anybody ever. And we didn't really play instruments. But so we grew up, though, just knowing that music was a place that centers us. And so I've always been a really eclectic person when it comes to music. I think one of the questions was like, what's your favorite kind of music? And oh, I don't know. I don't have one, right? One moment I'm listening to a lot of really heavy duty rap that has lots of inappropriate things in it. And then the next minute I've got classical music on. It just depends on the mood and where I connect. But from a really early age, I have the beauty of raising three children. The world's blessed us with three. Our 20-year-old is studying school psychology at college and recently took a job as an autism line therapist and a mental health therapist. And she's just such a neat human being. And then I have twin boys who are 15, and they were identified at a pretty young age as having some differences in their learning. So our Nick has autism, ADHD, and dyslexia, and he is just the most beautiful human being. And our Henry is just such a lovely, kind, empathetic little soul. But Nick, from the time he was really little, that's how we regulated his sensory system. So with his autism, if he was having a rough day, dance party in the kitchen, that's how we got back to center. The heavy motion and the body behind dancing and singing along just would regulate him. So when we would hire a new nanny to work with them, they'd say, well, what do you do when he's really off? And I was like, well, if you're going to work here, you're going to have these skills. And we crank up the music and we dance. And if they would say, oh, I can do that, we're like, sweet, you're hired. And if they looked at me like I had two heads, I was like, this is probably not going to work out. Because I am making a complete fool of myself right now, and I could care less, because that's what means something to him. So from the time he was little, music's always been his thing. And now his thing that he's 15 is car DJ. So mom, could you crank up the tunes? Yep, sure can. What's the playlist? And he's not a natural communicator, right? So it takes these bridges and these connections. If you bring those into his space, he's such a beautiful communicator, but he needs that. And music is such a way we do that in our household. He'll tell you songs that he likes, what he's listening to now, who he wants to hear. No, mom, can't do that. Nah, turn that one off. Nah, mom, that's off the playlist, right? And I don't even know where he gets some of it from, but it's this moment in which we are completely connected to one another, talking about why I'm putting something on our playlist, or he is, or someone else in our household is putting something on our playlist. That it's just such a beautiful way that actually helps him communicate and connect to the world. It's a gift.
It truly is. And that is such a beautiful story. Music is that entry point. I mean, I always ask, what's on your turntable, or what are you listening to, or what's a song that makes you happy, or what's a song that reminds you of what it means to be alive? And again, those, what a powerful way that music is that entry point for your son. Not only is it an entry point for you to communicate together, but it's that entry point for him to find that niche, to find that kind of solid ground. Hey, this is my thing. This is our thing. That's so powerful. Thank you for sharing that.
We work really hard to find his connections to the world, and that's always been an easy one for us.
Nice. Now, speaking of connections to the world, I know you've written one chapter, and Because of a Teacher, Volume 1 book. And, I know that, and rightly so, you've had other obligations and other things, but you have a blog, Leverage Points is the name of it. And, So you're brewing that up again?
I am working wholeheartedly at getting back to the writing process. I have all kinds of thoughts and ideas that I've written down and following them through. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And so I've put that at the forefront, trying to balance a bit, making sure I'm giving students good feedback as I teach a class and actually building an inclusive community for regular ed teachers. One of the courses I'm doing that in is on a discussion board. So I dedicate a lot of time to just making videos and doing check-ins and things like that, because a whole online class and how to do that is a little bit more challenging. So I have gotten away from the writing and the publishing, but I have committed to getting back to it. So hopefully you'll see a blog post from me in the next couple of days.
Okay. And when you post it, please tag me.
Okay.
And is there a way that people can sign up for it, or is it just one of
those? Yep, it's right on WordPress, and it's I think it's leveragepoints.com or something like that, and that's what it's called. And so people can follow it all they would like. I have all kinds of good stuff out there right now that seems to keep coming back up, as they're pretty common themes around building student-centered practice and supporting educators. But I promise to get back to writing about some of the great things that I've seen and just some of the things that we're trying to work on as a system now, as I get to join this new community and help it grow.
Well, I look forward to that, because I do love your writing voice and I love your storytelling ability. And I just find such kinship and warmth and empathy in it. So I'm just asking for selfish reasons, you know. Keep reading.
I'll do my best, John, to make that more of a priority.
Because when I have my Edward Scissorhands moment, I'm going to just say, hey, you know, check out Deidre Raymer's blog, Leverage Points. Here it is, you know. So that's for sure. I know you just recently, you and your family just had a wonderful excursion to France.
Yeah, that was several years in the making. We'd been planning that one for a while.
Well, I loved following that journey on Instagram. And so thank you for sharing that. Do you have any, and again, I know your plate is full.
Yeah.
As I'm listening to you, and we've been talking for just a little bit of time, I'm thinking, when is the Deidre TED Talk coming? when is the conference keynote coming?
Yeah.
Do you have any of that in the works?
Yeah, I've done quite a bit of presenting in the last number of years, and I love that side of the work, because I learn as much from sharing the story and from hearing other people's story as I do when I, you know, get to share the story that I have. So I have a couple of conferences hopefully coming up in the spring that I'm getting back into the presenting realm around, but I don't know so much about the rest of that, Sean. Give me a little bit of time to get acclimated into my new community. And there's so many celebrations to share about the work that's happening in the School District of South Milwaukee. And then this beautiful story being told about how we're trying to shift to a more student-centered approach and what that's going to take to get a system to move. So keep on the lookout. I'll do my best to capture our story and share it as best I can with the staff and the students that I get to serve every day. Because usually when I get invited to be on a podcast or whatnot, I usually say, I'm happy to come, but I'm going to bring kids or I'm going to bring students, or right, they do the work. I don't. I just get to shape it and help them figure out what that is.
Right on. And I appreciate how you value the power of what story is and what it means. You've shared that throughout. Even before I hit record on this, you talked about the story of the strategic plan. You've talked about how everyone had, you know, brings different elements to that story, and everyone is, it's a shared experience. And I think if, you know, if we were to redesign principal school, There's definitely needs to be a storytelling class, storytelling as a leader, and you would need to teach it or at least write the textbook. There I go, adding more stuff to your plate. But but again, that's just a, you know.
Yeah, put that out there. I do talk about storytelling and the power of it quite a bit when I work with pre-service educators in my classes at UWM, and the power of empathy. That's one of their assignments, is to go out and do empathy interviews and find out what the student stories are. And that's the one I get the most positive feedback on. Like, oh my gosh, I didn't know this about the kids. I was like, great, because sometimes we need to frame the questions differently to hear a different part of the story. And I'm always grateful when people share parts of their personal story with me, because it helps me to know how to best support them in the work or best support them as people too.
Absolutely. Deidre, what's the best way for folks to follow your story and to engage in story with you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. I do try to put out pictures and a bit of our story on Twitter. Again, I'll do my darndest to get back to the pod or the blog. But we also do have a podcast in the school district of South Milwaukee that our communications coordinator has started with our director of instruction, both two brilliant human beings. They started this together actually in response to some pushback they were getting from the community. And they said, well, what if the community just knew more? So we do have a South Milwaukee podcast called the SM Way, on which I am a somewhat frequent guest. So people can follow our SM Way podcast, and it's a lot about just what we're working on as a system and finding the joy in the kids and finding the joy in the experiences that we're able to provide. So people can also follow that one, because it's pretty awesome.
That and I'll be sure to put all those links in the show notes for those to follow and bookmark and download and add to their professional learning network pieces. So, Deidre, I am just so grateful for your time and your gifts and you sharing the story of not only your own narrative thread, but the story of the people that you get to serve and support. And I hope one day I'm supposed to head up to Illinois at some point in 2024. I'm hopefully will be able to work my way to the Wisconsin, South Milwaukee area, maybe during that same trip.
That would be great. We have lots of good things to share and show off.
Well, we're rightly so. As we're about to sign off here again, thank you so much, Deidre Raymer, for being a part of this connected conversation for the Principal Liner Notes podcast. I'm so grateful for you.
And thank you, Sean, very much for the message you put out on the daily basis, and also for including me in the opportunity to share mine.
Most grateful. Don't forget to share with the world your dreams, your ideas, your visions, and your stories, just like Deidre does, because the world needs them and you help make the world a better place. This is Sean Gaylord from the Principal Liner Notes podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hope to catch you on the flip side.